finally got myself to where the abstract work is saying what I want to say yeah. in a way that I can't imagine representational work saying. And so that's so fun. And it's been such a year of growth in that way.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Art Juice. This is behind the scenes conversations about making art and the creative life with me, Alice Sheridan. And today we have something different for you. Today I am joined by Megan Woodard Johnson. You're going to have to tell me if I say your name properly.
That was perfect.
Good. And we are just going to be having a chat about her work along similar lines to the way that we usually talk in Art Juice, but we just thought it would be a lovely opportunity to get to know some of our listeners and fellow artists a bit better. So welcome, Megan. It's lovely to have you here.
Oh, it's so nice to be here. Thank you.
So I have been lifting your copy from your website, where it describes you as a mixed media artist who layers vintage paper ephemera with paint, various drawing media, and then found objects which tell evocative stories. How long ago did you write that on your website?
Or is that last week? No, I'm just kidding. I think I really sort of built that website and put my artist statement together about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago. But I update it, and my work has changed and shifted just a little bit in the last year. So actually it is true that last week I updated the verbiage.
So we are fully current, because yes. It's one of those things, isn't it, that I think we look at when we first put a website together, and then we think, right, that's done. And then you kind of go back. I know I do. Sometimes I go back to it and I think, is that what it still says? I need to change
yes,
things.
Absolutely. It's sort of on my list of things to do to start reaching out to new galleries and show opportunities and things like that. So I did a little updating because I wanted to make sure that anybody that clicked on the link from my emails got the best, the most curated site.
Full marks for you. Now, obviously, we can tell from your accent that you are not in England.
I'm not.
So where do you live and work?
So I live in West Bend, Wisconsin, which is a medium to small sized town northwest of Milwaukee. So then the next closest, biggest recognizable city is probably Chicago. We're about 2 hours from Chicago, but in the state of Wisconsin in the U.S.
And have you always been there?
No. We moved around a lot when I was growing up, so you don't need to get the whole, childhood story. But most of my growing up time was spent on the East Coast of the states, in New Jersey, and so close to Philadelphia and New York-ish. And then I went to college in West Virginia, just south of Washington, D.C. And then I moved out to the Midwest after college.
Okay.
So really, now I've been here for a long time. That was in 96.
Once you get settled, it feels like a while, doesn't it? Okay, that's great. That's put you in context a little bit more for me. Not that I've ever visited Wisconsin. I'll have to add it to my list. If I were to come to visit, what would you show me?
Oh, Wisconsin is beautiful. And the city of Milwaukee has a lot of amazing art and some beautiful architecture. And it's right on the coast of the Great Lake, Lake Michigan, which almost feels a little bit like an ocean because you can't see to the other side. It's it's a beautiful city. It's got a lot of great stuff. So we would go eat amazing food and see some great art. And, I like to just hang out.
Hatching ideas. So we're going to dive straight into, we usually talk about what we've been working on this week. So just in terms of, the general ebb and flow, sometimes we have weeks where we're full on in creative mode and other times it's other things. And I just like to illustrate that a little bit. So how has this week, now we are talking on a Tuesday, so let's talk about last week. What was going on for you last week and coming up this week? Well, what have you got coming up?
In terms of that ebb and flow, my whole June was really oriented around exhibitions and shows and that sort of thing, and not very much oriented around the making of art.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of lead up in the previous months, and then June hit with two outdoor art fairs in Chicago, and then a weekend full day of workshops at a friend's farm that I help organize, and I teach workshops, and we have several other artists teaching. And then actually last weekend, Friday, was the opening reception for a group show of seven artists that I and a friend, another artist, curated. So there was a lot of this sort of culminating, you know, conclusions to months and months of previous work. So this week, yesterday in particular, was mostly sort of a mind melt, just a, I just sort of was collapsed yesterday. But if we were talking on this week's Friday, I would hope to be able to say, this week I just spent the time in the studio doing studies and just playing with no real agenda other than a hope to sort of reconnect to the making of the art and the what I want to explore. And so we are in a little bit of that transitional space.
I want to ask you later about the workshops, but you brought me around to this, you know, the ebb and flow of creating. When you're in a stage where you're getting ready for events or exhibitions and putting things together, how much do you enjoy that period, or does it feel like an unnecessary interruption?
You know, I really like it, and I'm okay with the pause in the making. Mm. I have been making art almost completely full time for probably about 5 years. We can get into that as well. But, so I've recognized like a whole calendar cycle, and I've been doing those sort of summer art fairs for 3 or 4 years. So I know that in the summer I'm taking all the work and showing it, and I really don't have a lot of time or energy for making art. This summer, I'm hoping to have a little more time for that. But I actually love the framing and the finishing of pieces and the wiring. And I really am a sort of DIY person, so I still do all of that myself. I get really nerdy about packaging things up and packaging my vehicle to bring to these shows.
I've seen your car packed up. You have, for anybody who didn't see this, gosh, I hope I've got the right person here. You have you had this amazing setup in your car where you had it all on different support structures and ledges to slide in all the things for your booth. Was you, wasn't it?
It's true. Yeah, that's me. And I believe I saved that in the stories, the highlights of my Instagram, because it was kind of fun to document. So the art fairs that I do in the States in the summer are the kind where the artist ports their entire tent set up and all of their work and all of their checkout, like everything. It's a whole little business that fits in a 10 by 10 square foot booth to these shows that, you know, pop up in a city for the weekend, and then you have to bring it home again. And there are artists that do 30 of these shows a year, and they have giant vehicles that are designed for transporting across the country. And I don't aim for that range. Mm-hmm. So I try to make everything work in our family vehicle, which is sort of a mid-range SUV. But it does mean that we sort of created some structures within the back that hold certain things. And then I have packages that hold the paintings, and
it looked amazing. It was a bit like one of those impossible puzzle things that, you know, it's going to all fit together, but it's got to go in exactly right thing in the right place at the right time in the right order. And the other thing that I find interesting when I'm packing the car up is it's not just about fitting it in the car. Some of it is about the order in which you need to be able to unpack it too.
That's exactly it. And especially I'm constantly concerned about if you're setting up one of these outdoor art fairs in the rain, you know, what do you might have to pull out a bunch of stuff to get to the things that actually make the tent that protects you from the rain. So it is, but I've always been a little nerdy about, you know, packing suitcases and all that kind of stuff. So it clicks into a good part of me.
But I think it's the same thing. I think that there is, I know from talking to other artists that there are lots of artists who found their way to this kind of creative space via some other creative approach.
Oh, and, sure.
And I think that it's a general desire to problem solve, create something out of nothing, find a new resolution to react to what's around us. And it's all the same issues, isn't it? And I don't think that goes away, which is actually why I think artists make quite good business people because we're always challenging, problem solving. Where we go wrong is we listen to people who tell us that, you know, if you're going to be an artist, you're never going to find a solution to any of this. But actually, left to our own natural devices, we're constantly creating new ideas, or how about should I try this thing, or this is going to be a new way that I'm going to put things together.
I'm loving this conversation because one of my dear friends, who's an amazing artist, we did a discussion with high school students, and really our aim was to talk to their parents about reassuring them, essentially, if their kids wanted to go study art and potentially make a career out of art. But really it was, if your child wants to study art, that doesn't mean they're going to be, you know, just a poor artist living in a garret. And one of the things that this friend of mine brought up was her belief that artists were the original problem solvers, because before we even make a thing, we invent a problem. We invent an idea, and then we invent how we're going to solve it, how we're going to create it, how we're going to process it, all of that. And there's no way in the world that somebody with those sort of problem-solving, problem-creating skills wouldn't be an asset in any business anywhere. So the conversation we were having was, if your child goes to school for an art degree, even if they don't end up pursuing the arts, they're going to be an asset, and they're going to be able to find good, you know, wonderful places to bring that creative energy all through their life.
Yeah, and it's a way of hanging on to that creative thinking and that openness as well. I mean, I often do it within my own work. You know, people say, do you have a plan for it? And it's like, no, not at all at the beginning. But as you say, it's the problem comes along in the middle of it. Like, I start and there is no problem because I haven't created anything yet. Like, there isn't a problem with a blank thing. You know, it could be anything. There is no problem there. Mm-hmm. The problem comes halfway when you've got different things going on the, or what you want to create, and you've got to kind of sift through and identify what that is and turn it into a question for yourself. So how am I going to resolve this issue of X that's happening? And I'm not going to give an example because that's my work. So when you're working on yours, what kind of questions do you have for yourself at the beginning, or when does it emerge during the process of working? So when do you get to that stage where you think, aha, I think this group of work or this piece is going to be about, or do you have a problem of X, or is that not how you think about it while you're working?
I think that I largely work intuitively, and I let things build, and I let works build, bodies of work build. And oftentimes it's, you know, it can be about a year into working in a similar vein, or working with similar materials or imagery, that the idea is something I can articulate. Does that make sense? Yeah. I have a full background of learning the fundamentals of art. And so there's a lot of learning that I did early on that now allows me to work intuitively. But it's sort of the taking a step back. Whether you take a step back in the middle of a painting and you see areas that need to be resolved, or areas that are getting where you want it to be, and you start reacting to or feeding off of those, you know, that's one moment when you take a step back and things start to occur to you. But then I've also always found that it can be, you know, at the end of a year, seeing 20 pieces on a wall, that I find a thread, or somebody asks me questions about my work and my process, that I start to find thread.
Finally, the penny drops when you kind of see it, when it's almost finished, you think, oh, that's where it was leading. It's amazing, isn't it?
It's very true. And I remember that even in college as well. And I would work I was a fine art printmaking minor, and you know, I would just work and work and work, and then find the thread. And I was never one to keep sketchbooks of ideas. That, you know, I wouldn't sketch out a painting first. I would just go, and then it would resolve as it, you know, in process.
But your paintings often begin a similar way, by laying down the pages of the papers that you found. So those are usually quite neutral in colour. They're quite small scale. It's almost like, how to describe them, a patchwork. So you have all these variations in buff and white and printed and drawn pages. And that seems to be, and sometimes I kind of think, you could just stop there. I'd be happy with that.
I would be so much more productive if I could start at that first stage. And I can see it. I know those, their compositions in themselves. But you're right, the description of how I start my paintings, and this, I think probably about 8 or 9 years ago I started doing this, was an effort to that idea of activating the canvas, getting something down so you weren't, you know, intimidated by the big blank white paper or whatever. I started laying down just pieces of vintage paper material. And this is part of what I was talking about years later. It was at one of my art fairs when people were asking me to describe my process and what I used. The big question was, well, how do you decide what vintage papers you're collecting? And I realized what I really like to work with are papers that served a purpose for somebody in the past and help them stay organized or taught them something. There was this sort of rigidity to the quality of what those papers were used for that then also translates aesthetically into more neutral pages. So there are papers from old ledgers or children's coloring books or children's penmanship manuals. And so they're neutral with just maybe mostly black marks on them because they were meant for you to then fill in or follow through. And I started using those papers, I think, when my children were little, and I was drawn to them just aesthetically and nostalgically. And then I started also realizing I was drawn to the fact that they were a foundation of structure and meaning and rules and organization that is sort of the underpinning of all of our lives and our movement through the days. But also a really great contrast to my natural tendency to have very expressive brush marking and mark making and very vivid colors be what I'm drawn to use in terms of those mediums. So I really love the interplay between them.
And in very practical terms, what do you use to adhere those papers and where do you find them?
Okay, so I find them now. Originally, it started with things from my grandmother's house or things that people gave me. And now I do 2 to 3 big sort of all-day searches at giant antique malls where there's 100 different vendors selling everything old. And I always joke that I can go through one of those and I never notice a piece of furniture, but I can find a little stack of paper, you know, just zone right in on it. And now I've gotten to the point where a lot of people will bring me things. And because I know now what I'm looking for in those papers, I'm really able to quickly discern whether the things that people gift me are going to work for my art or not, whether they're, you know, saying the things that I want to say or not. Then they get sorted into what I use for workshops and what I use in my own work. So it's still
So the things that you don't use for yourself get used by somebody else. I was going to say, is there anything that somebody gives you that isn't what you might normally use, but that triggers something and you feel you have to, and that starts you on another, on a different trajectory?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's also the nature of this sort of found objects, is there's only so much that I can find. And then somebody else has something hidden away in their basement that they, you know, come up with, and it'll trigger new color usage or just, I originally only used really sort of black and white versions of things. And then I started being drawn more to, if it was a coloring book that had a really vivid color cover with all sorts of crazy, because it's, you know, geared towards children, I could cut out a small section of that cover and I lose the fact that maybe it's a, you know, a bunny rabbit on the cover, but I find a corner that has red and green and like really crazy, almost garish colors. But if I use that as a small element of one of my paintings, it's just that little shock of something different that then sends me into a new direction. So that is really fun when somebody brings me something that maybe it wouldn't have occurred to me to pick up. It'll trigger a new idea.
And is it just gloss medium you use to stick them on?
Actually, typically I start with a what is it, a PVA glue. So it's it's an acid-free glue used a lot in bookmaking and bookbinding. So that works really well in terms of the adhesion. Medium, it just isn't thick enough or sticky enough for that first layer.
Yeah.
And then also because it's such a gentle glue with these old papers, it lets them lay very flat, and it doesn't affect the papers or sort of, it doesn't make them wrinkle or tear or anything like that. It lays them down nice. And then I've never had any problems with delaminating or peeling up or anything. I do use matte medium as a barrier coat almost in between almost every layer of not only the collage elements, but in between layers of painting to sort of seal in like marks and then be able to keep working on top of them.
Do you ever use wallpaper paste? Because when we used to do sheen colle in printing, using acid-free wallpaper paste or wheat glue was a way of binding the papers together as it went through the press.
And it doesn't ever, I wonder if it would peel up. Because you know how essentially the way you remove wallpaper is to spray it with water and it'll peel off of your walls. But I wonder that.
It can be pretty tough though, can't it, when you have to strip wallpaper?
Sure can. Yeah.
I think once it's covered by so many other things, it would be pretty safe. But I've always wondered if, you know, because, you know, wallpaper paste is what they use for, you know, objects made out of paper mache, isn't it? And that's, once it's dry, it's pretty tough.
Oh, you're right. It's, yeah, then it's really solid.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah, good tip.
Maybe worth a try. I don't know. So when you come into the studio, do you have a daily routine or a weekly routine? Is it?
So right now we're in summer break and I do have two school-age children. So my weekly daily routine is sort of all over the place. But when I have the whole solid day, I do try to keep myself focused in the studio for a good 4, maybe 5 hours if I can, and go let the dogs out. And I'm in a rented studio separate from my home, but close to my home.
Okay.
And then try and take the, you know, next couple hours of the day to sort of do some admin work. I do know that for being purely creative, like the energy required for painting per se, I can sustain that for maybe 3 hours in a day. Yeah. With breaks and wandering around. And I share a studio with a friend that was originally an apartment, a flat. And so it has a little sitting area and it has all these little spaces, a lot of good places for me to distract
myself.
Too tempting. Yeah, it can be bad. But it, you know, it lets me take that 5 hour block and really use it in a bunch of different ways. So I may be working on vigorous painting and then sort of get a bunch of pieces to a place where they need to sit for a while. And then I can turn and start doing this background collage on new surfaces to have them ready for the next phase. Or I can go paint or work on framing or work on, you know, those sorts of things.
Yeah, because those different stages take different things from you, don't they, in terms of output? I mean, I know that once I get started with the painting, I can get carried away and kind of go for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. And it's only once I stop that I realize I'm like, that was really good. When the minute I stop, I'm like totally fired up. I feel like I could do anything. Oh, and then later that evening, I feel totally wiped out.
I'm completely exhausted after a full painting day. It's just wild. And it's not that I'm not painting huge paintings that take a lot of physical, you know, strength or effort, but I just think there's something draining about that energy. It's like a, you know, just a burst of energy that then you need to recover from.
And I think it's that continuous problem solving that we were talking about at the beginning. Ooh. You know, it's hard. It's hard brain work too, actually, if you're doing
it
properly. Whereas the parts that are, like you say, collaging the elements at the beginning, that's quite contemplative. That's quite calming and it's a different energy that you need to put into it. So having those So do you, when you come to it in a day or in a week, do you always start with one of those things and lead up to the other? Or do you very much go, I feel in the mood for X, so this is what I'm going to start with today?
Yeah, I try to tap into my mood. You know, I don't want to give myself too much credit as being like very organized about this. Sometimes I tap into my mood and sometimes I can let that override, you know, sort of, I can talk myself into thinking that I'm not in the mood to paint. Mm-hmm. and distract myself for a while. When really then, if I just put some music on and get the paint going, within like 10 minutes, I'm in the mood to paint. I'm one of those people, I really recognize how important routine can be. I take it all the way back to when my first child was born and keeping to a nap schedule. I knew nap schedules, eating schedules, all that kind of stuff, it really made our days go better.
Yeah.
But after 3 days of sticking to a schedule, I would just be like, forget it. We're going to just do whatever we want today.
And I'm like that with meal plans too. I kind of think, gosh, this would make my life so much easier if we had a real system. And I did it once. I think we had a meal plan for every 4 weeks. But even within that, I was like rebelling against my own meal plan. I don't want to eat this tonight.
Yeah, exactly. And So I find the same way with my studio practice. I did do an artist in residence for, it turned out to be about 3 months at our high school last year, which was so fun. I was working 2 days a week outside of, you know, art. So 3 days a week, when I would normally be going to my studio, I set up a temporary studio in one of the art classrooms. And the whole goal of the residence was not for me to teach or anything like that. It was for me to produce a body of work. I was getting ready for a solo show. But the students then got to see that daily process. And it really made me stick to some sort of routine because I had told them I would be there from 8 in the morning until 2:30 in the afternoon. And when it's my own day to go to the studio, I can wander in at 10, I can walk down the street for coffee. But this residency made me stick to a schedule. And that's where I really noticed that my energy first thing in the morning was wonderful for painting. And so I would put in like good music on my earbuds and I would just paint for about 2.5 hours. And then I was, you know, that energy was gone. But then I would sit and I would, you know, work out ideas, do a little bit of, you know, just sort of admin work that I could do. And then I would come back and do all that collage and the sort of contemplate work. And so I know that's the schedule that works well for me, but I don't always stick to it. That's really where I'm getting.
It's interesting though, because did you find that during that period where you were really being held to your working hours that you amazingly got a lot more done?
So much work done. So much work done. And there was a little bit of literally these kids were over my shoulder sort of, you know, seeing me every day. A little bit of a performative, you know, I want to do what I said I would do kind of thing. And then there were also days where the painting was just going horribly or I completely felt like I had ruined a piece. And what was really fun is I brought it into the advanced painting students and asked for a critique and it was fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. I think again, that's referencing your kind of conversation with the parents that you had about art. I mean, I remember being contacted once by an A-level student who she'd found my stuff online and she came and she spent a day and she was just amazed at all the different elements. The fact that it didn't always go according to plan. That's a really good thing for children to see.
It is.
I was going to ask you, how does making art fit with other commitments in your life? So how old are your children?
So they are 14 and 16.
Okay, similar to mine. And what what do they think of it?
You know, at this point, I really think they think it's no big deal. It's just mom's job, which I love. I really love that. I love that art could be seen as just sort of this is where she goes to work and this is what she does. And not that it's a huge novelty because I don't want art as a career, as a lifestyle to be a novelty. And then they see how exciting it is for me when I get work accepted somewhere and they see what a disappointment it is when I get, when my work gets rejected. Or when I have an event where a lot of pieces sell versus where I have an event where a lot of pieces don't sell, they see all of that. And frankly, they see that, last year we went on a vacation because of what I earned and that's probably not going to happen this year because of the ebbs and flows. So they see all of that. And when they were little, my studios were in our home. And so they were kind of, but they were never really the kids. I never let my kids have like a corner of my studio for making their own art. We always were creative and we have all that kind of stuff, you know, in the kitchen or somewhere else for them to use. But my studio and my space was my space. When we finally made it so, so that I had a studio. It was always separate. And then above and beyond that, they're not really into art right now.
Yeah.
We went to art museums when they were little, and we went to all of the sort of events, and they love that kind of stuff, but they have their own interests now. And I think that's great.
So over time, how has your art practice grown? What started you off? Because you said you've been making art consistently for about 5 years. What was life before?
Well, so I did go to school for art. I went to school and studied graphic design and fine art printmaking. And really, by the time I graduated from my college degree, it was 96. Everything about graphic design had gone fully digital. And I really don't thrive creatively on the computer. I can handle it. I can, you know, manage my spreadsheet and my taxes and all that kind of stuff. And I'm happy to spend a day doing admin, but I really don't like doing creative work on the computer. And I knew that pretty much right off the bat. And it took probably about a 10-year break where I took a career that was outside of anything creative other than I was, for a while, I was managing projects in a graphic design office. So I was doing the project management. And that was a great mix because I felt like I could understand the designer's perspective and the client's expectations. Yep. And, you know, that tapped into that same part of me that likes to pack the car for art.
Yes.
And so, and then I met a man that, you know, didn't specifically have any art or creativity in his career. And we just followed a different path, and had two children and left my career to be a full-time at-home parent. And I was creative in, you know, decorating our house or making
all the things.
Yeah, all the birthday parties and things like that. But I wasn't making things just for myself. And honestly, it was a therapist when my younger son was two that was just helping me work through some general, you know, unhappiness. And I identified right away that I told her right off the bat that I went to school for art, and I sort of, and she said, well, what are you making now? And I was like, nothing. I mean, I'm not. And so she said, you need to be doing that again. And so she, before I even really realized how big of an element that was to be missing, she pointed it out. And my husband, right away, we cleared out a corner of our tiny basement and made a studio. And like I said, it was separate from anything in the rest of the house. It didn't have a children's area. It was past the laundry room, so I didn't have to, I could go in there and just be in my studio.
And did that feel good? Was that enough? Because, you know, that's quite a difficult patch in, I think, when you've got young children and life is all consuming, that's quite a difficult patch in anybody's life, let alone trying to kind of kickstart your creativity again. So, I mean, I'm listening to what you're saying and recognizing a lot of, yep.
You might, just from previous, you know,
But the thing for me, I know that I don't think I would have been able to do it just in a corner of my house. I had to sign up to life drawing classes, A, because it was out of the house, and B, because that was a kind of commitment and I knew other people were going to be there and somebody else was going to lead it. Whereas being self-initiated is quite tricky. So that's impressive.
Well, it felt great. And I started just playing. And I remember, you know, a dear friend had a child, so I made a very small piece of art that I could send as a gift, you know, things like that. And I just started playing around. And I think this is where I said earlier that I was a fine art printmaking minor. And that really, by the time I was finishing college, the print lab is where I was spending all my time. And I loved working really large. And I fell completely in love with stone lithography, which I can't even remember the exact type of material you use, but it's like it's a giant thick slab of stone that you need to use like a big dolly to move around and put on a press that's, you know, as big as a room. And then I graduated and I moved across the country and there was no way to continue.
You can't do that at home.
No. But I also remembered, I think, and I don't know that I remembered this in a very specific ordered way. Like, I loved this about printmaking, so now I will try this. But looking back, what I loved about printmaking was the layering of the inks, and that each one went on sort of separately and then affected what happened before and affected what would come next. And I think one of my ways of continuing that exploration was this mixed media, where I could layer paper with mark making, with paint, and I was stitching things together on a sewing machine, and I was just making all sorts of different marks. I was working very, very small, and I was working in acrylic and all water-based materials, so that if it needed to sit there for 4 days until the next time I got a nap time that was long enough that I didn't need to do something else during, I could get down there. And over maybe a year, I built up what felt like, sort of a style of work and a body of work. And then had a friend say, you should talk to this friend of mine who owns a boutique and is always open for the sort of first Friday gallery walks, because I bet she'd love to have your work in her store. And that's what I did. So that was my first opportunity to bring all of this work out of my little studio and show it. But it was easily a year and a half after I had, started kind of just playing around in the studio. But it was a great opportunity to sort of frame and price and inventory list and all that kind of stuff.
I think as well, you make a really good point about choosing materials or working with materials that are appropriate for you mm-hmm. at the time. And, there can be a desire to do more or bigger or print. I mean, I love printmaking too, but it's identifying those parts of it that you like. So for me, it was the surprise, and it was the kind of magic of the process that there was something else that went into it beyond the directness that sometimes you have with a paintbrush. So right. Finding ways to reintroduce that surprise and mystery into painting. Absolutely. That's what I took from printmaking.
Yes,
I can't have a press at home either. Or I could mm-hmm. do. I could have a small one, but I don't want to have a small. Right.
Who wants a small printmaking press? But what's interesting is you reminded me that I can't remember. So we lived in that house. It always goes by what house we had. That helped me remember frames of studios. We lived in that house where I had that studio for maybe 3 years. And at some point I decided to take a Saturday class at the Milwaukee's Art Institute. The Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design had Saturday classes for no credit, just, anybody could take them. And the only one that fit in my schedule was drawing draperies for still lifes. I had no desire to learn how to paint still lifes or do anything like that. And I wasn't interested in really furthering my realism skills, though, as a part of a real traditional art education, I knew that I had those skills. But I took the class because I got to go into the city every Saturday by myself with a portfolio. I felt like I was a kid again. And and all it was doing was reconnecting my hand to my brain, to my eye. Yeah. And it was just one of the best things that I think I ever did for myself as an adult artist. And I'd love to do it again, regardless of, I'm thinking about taking, doing still, or not still life, doing life drawing classes. Yeah. It won't ever be anything that shows up specifically in my work, but that it's sort of a reintroduction of the different parts of you that connect to make art is a really great experience.
Anything like that, I think, that exposes you to something new or a different practical technique or a different way of working, or, sometimes it can just be the conversation that you're having with people who are on that course. I remember when I did printmaking, it was really interesting because there was a guy who was a retired doctor, and there were people who'd been an architect, and actually the kind of conversations that you have with people is different in a life class because you have to concentrate and you can't talk. But in a printmaking studio, you can have conversations, and it was that as much mm-hmm. as actually what we were doing that I was used to find would like trigger ideas and thoughts and would have me thinking about things in different ways. And so draperies, still life, whatever it is, that's really specific class, by the way.
Oh, it was. It was so specific. And it was so fascinating, just as an aside, whether this, is interesting in the podcast or not, that there was such a specific class because the theory of the instructor was that so many people do still lives,
yeah,
but sort of ignore the surface that those objects are sitting on,
right.
And then that makes the whole piece fall flat. And even right, that
it kind of gets left around the edges.
Yeah, or the drapery doesn't look very convincing, though the apple and the bowl are incredibly realistic, and it just. That I think is just an interesting larger lesson of paying attention to all of the elements
yeah.
of your work that I probably carried along. But
I think still life tends to get ignored, I think, because it's something probably that's a little bit boring that we do at school, but actually a really good still life setup.
Oh you know,
it's a pretty skillful thing to put together. My mum always tells a story. She had a painting class that she took that was led by Maggie Hambling, who's, you know, pretty amazing British artist, but she used to paint, teach classes in this adult education center, similar, I think it sounds like, to what you were doing. But one day they all walked into the room and there were three green pears on a dark cloth. Mm-hmm. And apparently one of the students said, "Oh gosh, three pears, that's going to be hard." So she went up to the table and she picked up one of them so that there were only two left and said, "There you go, that's harder." And I just love that because it's so much about what you put into it, you know, mm-hmm. choosing your draperies, choosing your object. It's all those kind of decisions that go before you even start to sit down and paint and draw.
Yeah.
And then how you frame it, how you choose it, what angle you take, you know, there's a lot to think about. So
no, it's true. And then to what you were saying, getting out and working with other people in the room, because yeah. being a studio artist can be very isolating.
Yeah.
And so I think anything that you can do that connects you to other people and other artists is a really valuable way to kind of sustain yourself, or at least it
yeah.
is for me. So anytime I've had an opportunity to have work critiqued, certainly shows and things like that are great, but in process, meetings with other artists are invaluable for me. And I think kind of recreate that art school feeling of you would bring your work into your class, you know, every week and get blow by blow critiques or see what other people were doing and it would allow it to influence you. And I think that I've missed that a lot as an adult artist outside of school.
Yeah.
So in the last couple of years, I've tried to sort of really make sure that I'm doing what I can to sort of recreate that.
Yeah, I think it's tough. The whole idea of critique I find it's really important as a learning tool, but mm-hmm. you have to be prepared. And I don't know if this is something that social media has changed in the sense that we put things out and we like it if we get, you know, likes or you get, mm-hmm. or you get people saying it's lovely. Actually, when we're learning, we want people to say, yeah, this is lovely, but, you know,
right.
And it's not what we are encouraged to do in normal conversation, but you do have to create a kind of structure in which it's safe to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that traditional art school critique where you know what the problem is that you're looking at and you understand what that person's work is about or what they're trying to resolve, you need sometimes people to push you a little bit further and challenge you.
Yes.
It's a difficult thing to create.
Yeah. That's really true. And I think it has to do with finding the person whose opinion you are ready to hear and value.
But also somebody who asks the right questions of your work, I think.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Whether they know you or not, if they're, you know, sort of a person that can handle offering a good critique, they're going to, and then you, especially if they don't know you or don't know your past work, they're just responding to the piece they're looking at. And that's really valuable because you can sort of take your personal element out of it. You don't feel like it's a critique of you as a person. It's so easy for us to interweave who we are with the art that we're making.
Yeah. Although I think sometimes, I think you make a good point about, taking criticism from somebody who you admire. But I know that sometimes when I take a class with somebody, I almost don't want to look at their work in advance. Because if I look if I look at their work and I don't happen to like it,
mm-hmm.
then it it changes what I can get from that class. Whereas I know that I've had experiences in the past where I've been along and that person has been great at the way that they teach, or they've asked the right questions and they've prompted students in the right way. And then maybe I go and look at their paintings afterwards and I think, I'm not keen on those at all. But it doesn't matter, because in terms of the context of critique and teaching, they've been really good. So I think it's quite a difficult one, how to choose where you get that feedback from.
Right, it's true. I was really lucky about a year ago, my work shifted from having any kind of recognizable element in it. I used to sort of reference a house or architectural shape for a long series. And then I was shifting into fully non-representational abstract work. And it took me about a year to really make that transition, because I knew I would do abstract pieces and think, well, that's a perfectly perfect composition. And there's nothing you could say, you know, about this color or design, or, you know, but it wasn't saying what I wanted it to say. Yeah. So I knew I wasn't quite there. So it took about a year. And then I finally, you know, somehow managed to nail what it was that I was wanting to say. And then that sort of going back to, I could also then articulate what I wanted to say and why these particular pieces felt successful to me. And then an artist organization that I'm a member of, it's just a big guild, brought in a professional from one of the Milwaukee art universities to offer critiques. And so I didn't know her at all, but her background in education meant that she was, I mean, she was very, very astute and very, just really good at offering critiques from the full perspective of, I'm going to look at this work and I'm going to respond to the work. And you get to, you know, we had to tell her a little bit of what we were aiming for and how we were feeling about the work. But then really it was such a, what am I trying to say? It was a very objective view. And it came at a perfect time, because I was very excited about these two or three new pieces that I brought. And she helped me see, she helped articulate things that were happening in them that happened so intuitively. But she helped me recognize, like, well, this is what's happening. And so then I could go and keep those elements in mind as I worked further into the series.
Because sometimes when you're so close to it, there are things, of course, that you take for granted, you don't even put into words or recognize, because it's just, it is what it is, isn't it? So it's quite nice to have that mirrored back to you. But you teach as well, don't you? So tell me a bit about how often do you teach, in like a class a week or specific workshops?
So a couple of years ago, aside from doing all these mixed media paintings, I was also doing a lot of just traditional collage sort of studies, real just sort of abstract layering of papers. And I started to realize that that was like a level of creativity that I really felt like anybody could do. And I feel like collage is so fun, because that whole, when people say, but I can't even draw
it, takes away
lines,
the fear, doesn't it?
Yeah. I always say, well, I don't even bring pencils to my workshop, so you should come and you can cut and you can glue and we can do it. So I developed a workshop, also sort of watching so many people online, and people that I follow on Instagram seem to give workshops, and I thought this would probably be fun to do. So I kind of developed a collage workshop. So it's a traditional collage workshop that runs for about 3 hours. And I just sort of figure out on my schedule when I can offer one. And then before this current studio, which actually has a room that's large enough to do a small workshop in, I would find another art space and sort of rent their room for the workshop. And I would promote it just by Facebook, and, you know, it was just a real kind of a local thing. And so since then, I've had some other organizations ask me to do workshops, and it's a very portable one for me to do. And then I think this is our third year, a dear friend of mine who's a jewelry artist and lives on this wonderful farm with these beautiful outbuildings, she for years and years has held like sort of little homegrown art fairs and art events. We decided to try and put together a day of workshops with maybe like 5 or 6 different artists offering a workshop. And we've done that now for 3 years. And it does really well. I mean, we would always love for it to be, you know, something that people travel the world to come to. That's a future goal. But we have a lot of fun organizing it because both of us have sort of a project management background. And
so what time of year does that happen?
We do that in the summer, early and late sort of summer. So we did one in June and one in September.
Okay. So if you're listening in August.
Right. Yeah.
You know where to go.
In August, you can come to my website and there'll be information about the September.
And we'll share all of that in the show notes too for anyone who wants to come. And that was nice timing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Didn't have that plan.
So since I got this studio, again, like I said, there's a room in my studio that my studio mate and I built out as a workshop room. So we've got some tables and I have so many supplies for mixed media now, again, with collecting for years and people bringing me things, that I even have like a whole separate range of supplies. But I do a mixed media workshop now occasionally. And it still is something that like I look at my calendar and figure out when I can fit in this workshop, and I plug it in and then I try and promote it. And that one's longer. It's about 4.5 hours and because we get into paint and all of the different mediums and try and sort of cram that into one day. I really love teaching these workshops when I'm in them. Right now I know that I'm not organizing or marketing them in the most efficient way. So it's kind of exhausting and I'd like to sort of fine tune that so that I can be more sure that I'll actually fill up a workshop before I put all my energy into one.
It's a transition shift as well, isn't it? Sometimes, you know, when you're in a working phase on your own creative work, it's hard to think about bringing other people in and doing something else.
Yes, it's true. And so for me, I've found that developing a workshop and then just doing that one over and over again, it helps because I even have handouts that I give and that I've already designed. And even the workshop space is sort of set up in a way that's organized for these classes. And so it's always a lot of extra energy the first time you do a new one. And then if I could just sort of keep redoing it, it gets a little easier each time. So
do you learn something each time from the people who come and take part?
Yes, so much, especially with mixed media, because people will take all these materials that are exactly the same that I use in my studio every day, and they'll layer them differently, or they'll just treat them differently. And it's so fun. I say that at every class, that's my favorite thing about doing them.
Yeah, seeing what people will surprise you with.
Yep.
So have you ever had a time since you started doing this in the last 5 years, then let's say, when you felt like giving up? And how did you get through it?
Okay, so I should loop back a little bit to the arc of the career or whatever, because we talked about the very early time and the small work and small shows. And it all just sort of, it grew over the years, because now it's been 12 years, really, of always having art as a big part of my life.
Yeah.
And I've never felt like I should give up. I've been really lucky that every year, I think because I started really small, every year I've grown in the amount of work that I've created, the number of opportunities, I don't want to say quality of opportunities, but my art has become more serious. And so then the shows that I'm applying for have become more competitive. And every year my income has grown from it. And, so pretty early on, I feel really lucky that I was able to, at least pay for all of the supplies that I was using. So I wasn't draining from the family. And then that grew to where I had, a steady sort of, I always had money in my bank account for whatever next application fee or round of supplies.
I think it's having the trust that it's going to, I mean, you said you've been lucky.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. So,
but a lot of that is about your commitment to it, following through, having trust in your ability to continue. And, everybody has the days and the moments and the weeks where they wonder if it's perhaps quite all worth it. Mm-hmm. And even if it wasn't a whole year when you felt like giving up or not doing it, once you're on it and you know you've just got to keep going, half the battle, I think, really is keeping going, keeping looking for those opportunities, keeping responding to them, saying yes when they come in, even when they're a little bit scary.
Right. Yep, absolutely. And I think you're absolutely right. And I think maybe one of the reasons I used the word luck is because for so long I was just operating on this, like, I'm going to make the work and I know the opportunities will, they seem to sort of, your eyes open to them, even if you hadn't planned them out.
Yeah.
And then you're brave enough to take them and you go for it and it leads to something else. And, so it always felt a little lucky, like, oh, this just kind of came out of nowhere. But, you know, it didn't really come out of nowhere. I will say that right now I'm in probably my shakiest place. And it's nothing connected to my confidence of the art that I'm making or the quality of it or the value of it. Over the years, my ability to sort of tap into where my buying audience might be has always been, you know, pretty spot on with what I'm making and where I'm bringing it to show. And now my work is shifting and my desires for where I'd like it to be, you know, shown are reaching higher. And so that sort of quote unquote payoff, both with acceptances and with financial, with sales is, has shifted just a little bit. And so I feel like right now I'm in the place where I have to reactivate my trust in the whole process. And that even if this is sort of a down year on my spreadsheet, then it's not a down year across the board in terms of my growth as an artist and my commitment to my art. But I will say,
I think there's always a little bit of a gap, isn't there? That I think, you know, when you're working ahead of where you currently are, it takes a little bit of time, perhaps, for everything else to catch up to that and for you to change locations and who you're approaching and that kind of thing.
Right. And I think that for whatever reason, this is the first year that I've really felt that gap. And in the past, it sort of all was, it seemed to line up a little bit tighter. And my expectations of financially what I can contribute to my family are growing in importance as we're starting to look at colleges and universities and knowing that we have always been a single income family. And that was our choice for a long time about how to organize our budget. And we're doing great. My husband works really hard and it's worked really well for us. But, you know, a sudden need for another $35,000 a year feels really scary. I'm trying not to think about that too much. The one thing that I do know is that even if I end up having to sort of reorganize where my time goes, and some of it needs to go to a different job outside of the home that has more of a steady income, it won't change the work that I'm doing. It just might change the number of hours in a week that I can put to it.
Or you develop some of the other things that you've spoken about. And I think when you're kind of changing where you're growing, you know, many people start off doing this and thinking of it as a kind of a hobby, and then it's a hobby that brings in some money, and how lovely is that? And then it grows, and then you think, I've got to change things. And then there's a bit of a shift where, as you say, your expectations get a little bit higher. And I think the difficult thing to manage is to carry on to grow that, to start to see it as a business opportunity and an income, and still take great care over the part of it that is your creative soul part. Because what we can't do is lose that. We need that. And you need that to fire everything else. Mm-hmm. But also, like, going back to your residency, you know, we don't want to start treating everything like a job. But then if it's got to fulfill things a little bit like a job, you've just got to manage those two. It's a tricky balance. Yeah.
Oh, but, it is. But it's, you know, I was joking, with another friend, another artist friend, and, you know, seeing the list of where he was having shows next, and we're just sort of always checking in on what's everybody doing next, or where are you going? And I was joking that I had a meeting scheduled with myself the next day to discuss future goals and plans and steps to get there. And, you know, like, if I can put myself in the mindset of, like, oh, here's today, I'm having a meeting with myself. You know, it goes well. And like I said, I like that sort of organizational end of things. And I think, where were we that, now I can't remember if honestly, this was a podcast that you were Erin, or our actual conversation that we've been having, but that idea that like marketing your work or finding those opportunities, it's not a through line. It's not a perfect, I think the word used was a funnel. So you have to let some opportunities come up and know that they may show some fruition, you know, way down the road,
yeah,
or in a completely unexpected way.
Yeah.
But you still go for them. And, yeah, you know,
And I think a lot of it is just this understanding that as you grow, you know, one of the questions I had is, you know, what's next for you? And sometimes we don't know that. We don't know what's coming up next for us, or even necessarily where we want to be working towards. You know, we don't want to define it quite so closely. It's not like setting rigid goals that we have to live to. It's more about just knowing that you're ready to expand your horizons into whatever is coming next for you. And that just sets your mind in the right place to say yes to things and not be hesitant. And I think that holding your dreams gently is the only way that I've thought. I just know that when I start to get angsty and too organized about it, that's when things start to kind of stifle a little bit and it doesn't work quite so well.
That's really true. And, well, it's interesting because this month was the sort of culmination of a lot of planning over the last 6 months. I do have some art fairs that'll finish out the summer, and I have a small solo show in December. So I have some specifics that are on the calendar, but I've noticed that I think a part of this growth in shifting to completely non-representational abstract work, which is something that I, for some reason, had this, you know, this desire to do for so many years, and had this dumb belief that I wasn't brave enough, or you had to have a certain amount of bravado to be able to paint abstractly. And I let those limiting beliefs go and finally got myself to where the abstract work is saying what I want to say in a way that I can't imagine representational work saying. And so that's so fun. And it's been such a year of growth in that way. And then I've started working larger and larger. And all I know specifically about what I want to do in the future is keep this exploration going. And so specifically what that feels like to me is I want to keep exploring with working larger. I've also had a couple of, opportunities that we're thinking about for collaborations, which I feel like collaborations really force you into a new direction. And the first one came from a friend who's a potter who wants to create some pieces and then have me glaze them in my style. That I'm so excited about, and I have no idea what that will look like. And I told him last time I used glaze was in high school. So I don't know how it works at all, but I'm so
that could
excited.
Be really interesting though, because you can do all sorts of things with transfer on ceramic, can't you, to tie in the papers.
And, absolutely. And mark making. And there, so we've been, you know, sharing back and forth, other ceramic artists that maybe work in a really expressive glaze style. And he does mostly that's sort of like wood fire, really natural sort of glazing style. And so to take then what people recognize in his forms and then put my kind of craziness on them, I'm just over the moon. I'm so excited about that. I can't stand it. And that sort of made the idea of what if we could curate a show of unexpected collaborations and find other artists and link them up with people that they would maybe never work with or are in completely different mediums. So that's sort of a long range thing. And then, like I said, I had a chance to curate a show with a friend, and we gathered, there were 7 artists, and that was such a great project. And it made me think I'd love to do another show, just maybe with one other artist, that we have some things that link us together, but our work ends up looking very different. So that feels like a collaboration, more of a exhibition collaboration, where we wouldn't be working on the work together, but the show together. And so those sorts of things feel like they're pushing me in directions that are further out from the last several years, which were very focused on, you know, make my work and bring it to an art fair to sell. Like this sort of, I don't think I was ever really working with a product-based, you know, focus, like my art is a product, but I was very much feeling like the path I'm on is to get my work directly to the consumers. And I certainly still want to do that. My favorite thing really is, I mean, if I make something that somebody else responds to so strongly that they want it in their home so they can see it every day,
it's special.
It's such a big win. And it just feels, my work is always about connecting with people and experiences. So that feels like it brings it full circle.
But it sounds like you're diversifying much more.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it feels like I'm stretching into this, I don't know, maybe it's a little part of me that feels like I'm back in art school to be like putting interesting shows together with other artists. And so that feels really exciting. So if there's any goal for the future, it's to keep following new ideas.
Doesn't sound like you're going to run out of any.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Before we finish, we try to finish on something that's inspired us for the week. So this can be an inside thing, so how you've noticed responding to something or how you feel about it, or an outside thing, book or an exhibition or something like that. So thinking back recently, what would be the thing that has really kind of lit a little spark in you?
Yeah, I think it would have to be this show that I'm in right now with these six other women. And I think the reason isn't so specific that, you know, their artwork inspired what I think my artwork is going to do. It's the connections with them that created this event.
How did that come about?
You know, I have a friend who's a soft sculpture artist, and she's a, you know, fiber arts and soft sculpture, and our work looks so different, but we use a lot of the same words to describe what we're interested in. So there's attachment to memory and nostalgia and piecing together materials. And we're also both mothers. And we talked earlier about, I think it's great that my kids kind of, you know, don't think it's anything real big special or that it has a big impact on them that I'm an artist. And I used to think I really wanted to compartmentalize the two things and just say, I'm a working mom and the work I happen to do as an artist, and there doesn't need to be a big conversation about the two. But the truth is that a lot of the way that I see the world and the connections that we have and the layers of our experiences and our memories has been really brought into focus by being a mother. And so this friend of mine, her work is very much about motherhood, and we decided that we would like to curate a show featuring other artists who are mothers, who aren't making art about motherhood, but who are pursuing a, you know, full-time or very concentrated focus on art as a career in motherhood. And then we also wanted to have a panel discussion with them about how those two things interwove. And it was just a really interesting experience of taking something that I had sort of tried to separate a little bit and letting it come together, and then working with these other women and hearing their stories and talking to them, that tapped more into the fact that the real thing that drives my art is our connections with other people and our connections to all of the experiences that we have in our life that kind of layer up to make who we are on a given day. So that was really inspiring, almost because of how it sort of, after a very production oriented couple of months, it connected me back to what I want to make art about.
Sounds, I love the panel discussion part of that when you were sharing it. That was really good.
It was good.
And you've got more information about that on your website, haven't you? Mm-hmm.
I do. And the show will be over by the time this airs, but there certainly will be pictures on Instagram and things like that, just sort of featuring it. But the show ends at the end of July.
Okay.
So it's up for a month.
And if you don't follow Megan already, her Instagram handle is at Megan Woodard Johnson Art. And I'll put links to those in the show notes. And if you search for Megan Woodard Johnson Art on Facebook, you will find her too. And the website is just her name as well. So all the places. Thank you so much for giving up your time to be here. Thank it has you. Been delightful. Louise, if you're listening, we missed you.
Yes.
But I hope that you all agree that this was a fantastic alternative and lovely to have, you know, fresh ideas, new thoughts coming in. And it's really good to hear more about you. So thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm so pleased to be here. And gosh, it's just really, it really is my favorite podcast. And so I'm really excited to be a part of it today.
Yeah, this took us a while to get. We had a little message, didn't we, back in March, and said this would be fun, and you said this would be great. This has been on my wish list to do, and I said, well, that was easy. We can make that happen. And then it's taken us quite a while to get to this point, but I'm really pleased that we did. So thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, listen again next week, and have a great summer, everybody. And it's goodbye from both of us. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
What were we talking about? Timing. Sorry, that was really annoying that happened.
No, that's okay. Middle. I don't remember what we were talking about.